And we are talking six continents of innovation. So we've got esteemed leaders in each one of the leaders around the world, and we're going to be talking about innovation. It's not quite on the hour yet, so we'll allow for about a minute, a couple of minutes for people to join, and then we'll introduce our panelists and get straight into it. And I should make you aware as well, we tend to do three different questions and polls during our webcasts. Here is our advanced poll. What is the biggest influence behind your region's success with innovation? We've given you eight options, and hopefully if you can fill those out, and we'll discuss the results as we see them come in. The webcast should go for about 40 minutes, and then we will allow for questions and answers at the end of the webcast. So it's about the hour. We, best laid plans of mice and men, we'll allow for another minute for people to join us, and then we will get started. And there's just the question on bigger format. What do we say, guys? Indra, are you ready to do battle in this this great debate of ours? It's
a great day to talk about Asia and Europe and Oceania. I am ready. Lots of stuff going on.
Yeah, not sure about the battle though. this sounds scary.
We're gonna have a fun day because we have Indra and we have Andrea. So, Sean, you're gonna have to be really clear. So why don't we start with Sean and Andrea, and the two of us will talk, and Indra can go on mute until we introduce him in a minute. Sure. What we'll do is Sean and I will frame up the context for the conversation, and then we'll invite Indra to address it from the perspective of the places where he's been and the places where he's lived.
And really, as you recall, we did our first webinar and we opened it up to our crowd on our first webinar. And we said, what would you love to hear about? And guess which topic came to the top, the very one we're talking about today. So people have a hunger to know what's going outside of their own bubble. Certainly if you're in Silicon Valley, like we both are today, Andrea, sometimes you can probably get blinded to the fact that there are different worlds out there and they operate quite differently. So your context for starting our webcast, Andrea, what do you think?
Well, I think the first thing that I want to talk about from the context point of view is that I think that the audience that we've got now and the community that we're building is really teaching us a few things. I mean, one is all the things we have in common, but I think that all of the things that we have as different perspectives is just as important. And as we talk to Indra today and think about Asia and Europe and Oceania as three of the continents, and of course, in about an hour and a half or so, we'll talk about the three others. I think we can have a good discussion about places that we live, and then also I'd love to bring in some thoughts about the observations I have from the Copenhagen FinTech Week and the perspective of just having come back from really a great immersion from that perspective, not just the Nordic region, but what's going on in terms of what people did and didn't talk about. So framing that up, I think that's what excites me about today's conversation.
And as you mentioned, we are on live in another, 3 hours talking about this with three other different regions of the world, Africa, North America, and South America. We've just kind of for the being a little bit empathetic to our special guests that we've at least timed it such that we can actually get everybody on live at the same time. So, if you like the first edition and this one that we're going to talk about now, you might also like the second one. And I guess as a quick context, there may be a number of you that are flat earthers out there. I'm not making any aspersions here, but certainly from a corporate innovation standpoint, I think there's a recognition that the world is not flat. We do things differently. We have different economics and cultures and customers and different meta trends that actually govern how we do business, particularly with corporate innovation around the world. And I just wanted to set some additional context here too. As much as when you talk regions, you probably dip into these four different, you know, spokes of the innovation wheel, the startup spoke, the social innovation, public innovation, ecosystem innovation. One of our key focuses, and I know Indra is a specialist in this, is corporate innovation. So we're going to try to stick as firmly as possible as we can to how does a corporate innovator actually practice their business better based on understanding their regions better. And as mentioned, as always, there's myself and Andrea manning the wheels in terms of hosting this webcast. We're enjoying having the community respond, and it's being very educational. It's funny, when you re-listen to the webcast, we always sound a little bit smarter the second time around. So I feel great about that. And I want to also thank Joanne for corralling all of us together and managing all the background behind what goes into making one of these things happen. And so from a panelist standpoint, and we have some admission to make here, there's been some family emergencies and health issues going on with two of our panelists. We're trying to get Ross on before the end of the panel, but we do have certainly representing Asia and out of Jakarta, Indra Nugroho. I hope I pronounced that well. He's the CEO of Corporate Innovation Asia. He is a specialist consultant dealing with corporate innovation, particularly with a people focus. And so maybe I'll just get you to introduce yourself as well, and maybe you can unmute yourself, Indra, and say hi to our community.
Yes, thank you, Sean. Hi, everybody. Yes, my name is Indra, Indra Vanugroha, and the co-founder and CEO of Corporate Innovation Asia. And what we are doing in Indonesia and some neighboring countries is helping corporations to enable their internal talent so that these employees, they can actually design the innovations, develop, and then deploy, not just within their current market, but their expansions of markets. In the end, it's all about business performance. So it's more of a hands-on consulting in terms of developing the people for corporate innovation.
Wonderful. Perfect as well. Just A, your capability, and B, where you're located. You probably have a different perspective on how things work. Joanne is operating like clockwork here in terms of results. We asked the first poll question about the biggest influence behind your region's success with innovation, education and training, talent and workplace. So actually melding with what you just said, Indra, certainly the people factors involved in regional innovation seem to be scaling up fairly quickly. Although, you know, we'll get more votes hopefully as the next poll questions go on. So I thought I would set some context. I ran across some different headlines in terms of the different regions that we're talking about in this discussion. I'm not too sure if people are aware of this, but just yesterday, China launched their version of NASDAQ. So sometimes that type of information skates under the wheels of kind of North American media, but certainly that was big news. There is a thought in terms of just, are there these two universes, the East and West, and who will vie for number one? That's certainly a headline. I found this one interesting. I saw this the other day that EU has just surpassed the US in their innovation league table. There seemed to be some countries that went up. Estonia, I think, was one of them that really improved, and UK had gone down. And it sounds like we're on the heels of a new prime minister being called for UK today, if I've got my information right, Andrea.
Yeah, Boris Johnson. First thing when you wake up in the morning and you find out that Boris Johnson was just elected the Tory leader, you realize that lots has changed in the world in just a few months. And it feels like we're on the brink of being able to be, it will be completely impossible to predict future pretty soon because it's happening so quickly.
And I'll just mention Australia as well. I may play the role of Ross Dawson today if we aren't able to get him on. I've done a lot of work in Australia, and certainly this rings true for me, particularly as a Canadian as well, that, you know, similar sized countries, there seems to be a skill gap that people recognize in terms of innovation in Australia, and that may be holding their capacity to innovate in that country. So I also love the 2019 Edelman Trust Barometer. So they look at about 30 different countries, and it gives you a sense of just how different things are, not only across regions, but within regions too. So they asked about trust in business, and the high watermark was China. More people in China trust their business and doing the right thing than anywhere else in the world. And then I guess it goes down to a low of Russia at 34%. But if you look at the results across here, and maybe I'll just ask for a quick comment too, in terms of Indra, in terms of your Asia perspective, China very high, Japan very low, India is pretty high as well. Does this sync up with your view of the world? Are people fairly trusting of business in Asian countries?
Yeah, this is actually surprising because just a while back, a few years ago, everybody thinks twice about doing business in China. I did my bachelor degree in University of Melbourne. It was like about almost 20 years ago. And we learned about this bamboo network in China and how to do business in China. And trust is always number one issue.
Yeah.
We're preventing the West or outside China to actually do business with China. But now 80% trust. It's like number one. Yeah, this is very surprising. I mean, there's a lot of things that happen in China that actually will reshape the world that we all now live in.
I will qualify the stat as well. This is Chinese people evaluating their own country. So all of these numbers
okay.
are their own citizens.
Okay.
And then maybe I'll ask Andrea if there's anything in here that you're looking at, particularly given your most recent European experience in terms of make sense or?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. And I don't want to state names of people who aren't physically with us, but I had a really interesting conversation last week with Kasper Klinge, who is, and the group from the Danish and government, and looking at ways that various regions can themselves as a region create what I call bedfellows, you know, which partnerships, which relationships, which networks can you really do business with? Because we assume, you know, Sean and I have this philosophy that there should not be lone wolves. You know, we are beyond the stage where we should have lone wolves in business. And it was interesting because of all the things that people talked about in the Nordic region, especially in terms of what they might have as a regional advantage, trust and trust in business was one of them. And living in Silicon Valley, you know, people were not really excited about Facebook, and the Cambridge Analytica story was very negative when it came to being able to really do business with people. So the relationship between trust and willingness to do business, I have felt recently has really escalated to a very, elevated to a very important state in perspective. That said, it's very interesting that people within their own countries, and we'll hear from Africa and from Colombia and from and North America from a different perspective in our next webinar as well. Internal trust is pretty interesting, as Indra said, you know, for people to feel that they can trust their businesses. I think, trend-wise, it's probably going to be more and more important because we have so many global choices.
Couldn't say it better. I'm going to move on. I know sometimes you leave high school and you forget about geography and where the cities of the world are. So I actually did look at it's a really interesting study by Two Think Now that they do every year, where I think they've been doing it for 10 or 11 years, and they looked at the most innovative cities around the world. And for this discussion, I plucked out the top seven in each arena. Jakarta is not on there, Indra. We need to get Jakarta on the top seven of Asia. But these were deemed as the top seven in each region. So as we're talking about these regions today, these are some of the cities that you should be familiar with. Why don't we get into our first question? And this is like a real... kind of just overall summary of the health of the different regions. And maybe I'll throw this to you, Indra, in terms of Asia, and you can speak from your Indonesian perspective or the entire region. You know, what is some of the biggest trends, and how does Asian corporate innovation act similar to maybe the rest of the world, and how is it quite different? Maybe that might be an interesting opener.
Okay. Well, when we talk about Asia, we can't put it as a one Asia. So Asia is consisted of not just so many countries, but so many different cultures. So we always speak Asia in terms of countries within Asian region. There are different cultures, different policies, government infrastructure, different customer preferences, different markets. So it's probably best to, if you want to analyze about Asia, or we want to talk about Asia, we probably should divide Asia in terms of the emerging Asia and the mature Asia. So such as Korea and Japan, and the emerging Asia is China, India, and Southeast Asian nations, such as Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, etc. And when we look at the major Asian countries, such as Japan and Korea, I think the problems that they have is quite similar with the challenges faced by companies or countries in the Western part of the world, either in Europe or in the US. Why? Because, for example, Korea and Japan, they've been doing innovation since a very long time ago, maybe 50, 100 years ago. Even the US learned from Japan about how to work on their innovations within their manufacturing system, right? So the challenges that they face is more of a legacy challenges. You see, they've been doing innovations for a long time, so they have legacy system, they have legacy IT, they have legacy product, and these legacy things actually holding them back from actually exploring something new, taking risk of doing something that might fail in the future. And I think the same challenge are faced by big corporations in Europe or in the US. Now the emerging Asia is quite different. These are countries where they haven't been innovating and they're just starting to innovate within probably five or 10 years. So they are very fresh. They don't have the baggage of legacy. They don't have to carry that along everywhere they go. So they are free to explore new frontier, new opportunities, and all the exciting stuff actually coming from this emerging Asia. Just to name a few, if we talk about innovations in Asia about 5 or 10 years ago, then there will be terms like value chain innovations, very popular in Asia, you know, where you focus more on efficiency, and also frugal innovations, you know, where you break down a complex system or complex products, and then you remove all the unessential parts and focus on the essential parts, sell it at a very affordable price. So, and they focus more on the lower end of the market. But if you look at the emerging Asia today, it's completely different. They still have frugal innovations, value chain innovations, but they are now focusing more on business model innovations, technology innovations. They start to move up the market from the lower end to the middle class people. So yeah, a lot of exciting stuff actually happening within this emerging market. So I happen to be in Indonesia, which is one of the emerging markets, and I see it for myself that not only the big corporations, but also the startups, they're actually eager to do something that is different, that is something that is changing the country. Probably that's my first 2 cents, just to start with.
Can I ask a follow-up on that one? Because they ran across a study recently where recognized all the benefits of both emerging and kind of, the established Asia. But they said two things are holding most Asian innovation back, and I'm curious to know what you think on this. One was an aversion to risk, and another one was a fear of questioning authority. You know, are those true? Are they overplayed? What's your thought on that?
Right. So I wrote an academic article, a journal, about 5 years ago. It's about the influence of national culture to the ability of Asian corporations to innovate. And I use the Hofstede cultural dimensions as the reference, the main reference. And the two things that you mentioned earlier are the two dimensions of the complete six Hofstede dimensions. So one is power distance. It is true that in Asia, the power distance is quite high, and it's actually inhibiting innovation, because you don't question authority. You don't question what your boss is telling you. If your boss says you go right, then you have to go right, and et cetera. And then risk avoidance. Surprisingly, in most Asian countries, it's actually lower than some of, even from Germany, for example. So actually, in terms of risk avoidance, I think Asians are more risk takers in terms of that, you know, because of the, you know, not just the culture, but the political situations are not stable. So they are actually accustomed to change, accustomed to risk. So they don't have any problem with that. So in terms of power distance, yes, it is inhibiting the innovations. But in terms of risk avoidance, actually Asians are not risk avoidant. They are risk takers.
So one confirmed, one completely not right.
In my opinion, yes. Probably not apply to all countries in Asia. As I mentioned earlier, Asia is completely different. There is no one Asia. But there is one thing. I think there is one driver of innovation in Asia, and that one is the millennial generation. So these millennials actually coming to the companies and changes everything. So in terms of power distance, I think it is true 5 years ago when, you know, you don't question your boss authority. But these days, even supervisors can question their managers, or staff even can question their supervisors. Why? Because of millennials. They are all millennials. And all the Gen Ys and Gen Xs, or even baby boomers, they have no choice than trying to understand how the millennials work, act, behave, etc. So what I see today in every organization, most organizations, I would say, that the power distance is actually getting smaller, you know. Not all organizations, but the one that I interact with, I see that quite different from 5 to 10 years ago.
Andrea, I know you got your hand up here. You want to jump in?
I always, we've learned that our community loves specific examples, and certainly we don't want you to say the name of a company that would destroy some sort of confidentiality, but we would love to hear about the world of, you know, you open the door in a corporate setting. People have now talked about education and training being interesting to them, you know, talent and workplace, you know, and as you said, you know, the people within the company. If we were to visit one of the places that, where you work, you know, and sort of experience the challenge that you witness, what would you say that is a regional, you know, something special to the region or to the types of companies, whether it's legacy or emerging, where you walk into a corporate leadership and the challenge, what would the challenge be for people who are trying to bring innovation and growth within the companies that you work with? And once again, we would love specific stories without necessarily, naming the names of people who might want to remain confidential.
Okay. I think it's probably similar with the other parts of the world, not just Asian countries, that top leadership is actually sometimes it's like the biggest challenge. You know, how do you convince top leaders to change, to try to do something different, something risky? These millennials, they haven't been quite long in the company, so they don't get the trust of the top leaders, but they somehow have to move the company forward, right? So it's top leaders. It's mainly sometimes is like one of the biggest obstacles of actually doing something different, something radical. But I don't think that applies to all companies. For example, I just met a few days ago with he's the CEO of the company. It's one of the huge company in Indonesia, and he's 70 years old, but he has this vision. He's so energetic, a lot of energy. And I actually spoke not just with him, but with the rest of the BOD and the VPs, right? And what happened in the room is quite surprising, because the one is actually speaking about change, speaking about transformation, speaking about doing something beyond, go out of the box, is actually that CEO, the 70 years old leader. And what was very surprising to me is that the spirit of the top leader doesn't actually reflect it in the response of the rest of the people in the room. So actually it is the middle management somehow that doesn't actually believe that they can actually change. So it's very hard to generalize whether it is the problem of the top management or the middle management, very specific in terms of which company that we are talking to. Mm. Well, but studies always conclude that it is the mostly the leadership, the middle top leadership that is somehow preventing for innovations to actually happen within the company. And that's true in some of our clients. And we've been working with the clients to actually convince the top leaders first before we actually do some real innovation and in the lower part of the organization.
Well, there's a follow-up.
If I could just check in here, it's Ross Dawson here.
Oh, hi, Ross. How are you? Welcome.
Good. Thank you. So basically, I'm at the hospital with my daughter, who is going to be fine, but she's just staying here overnight. So it's a bit difficult to hop in. I might be able to try to get on the call from my car in a little bit. So if so, I will try to get on the call and chip in if I can usefully coming in so late in the conversation. But just wanted in any case to apologize for my not being able to join on the call. The little I've heard just now has been fascinating and very interested to, it's a very important topic, of course, around the, I love the diversity of Asia and how much is happening throughout the many nations and regions here and in Australasia. So hopefully I'll be able to chip in a bit later. If not, please continue having your wonderful conversation.
Do you have a quick thought on what's going on in your part of the world, or just a wrap up in terms of where innovation is going and, you know, the headwinds?
Well, if you give an extremely quick one, I mean, the startup community is very, it's good. A lot of strengths for Sydney in particular, and also Melbourne and Brisbane, and there's a lot of deep tech through the CSIRO, the National Research Institute. Australia has a very strong tradition in deep tech, particularly in, and also medical and green and agriculture and a lot of domains where there's totally, you know, world-class expertise. Corporate innovation in general is, I felt, being suffered from a somewhat conservative corporate culture, but there's some very good exceptions, and some of the banks and a few others are doing very well, but it's still grappling with the realities of making corporates innovative, being able to connect well with the startup culture, which of course is happening as is everywhere. So there's a lot of promise and potential. The federal government absolutely has been a drag on innovation for quite some time. It's just really is being very far down the agenda compared with most other nations. So a lot of good things and quite a few things where we do need to improve, particularly in terms of federal government support, driving some more extensive corporate innovation. There's a lot of great things coming out of Australia and New Zealand.
So I have a quick question, and then I'll let Sean follow up with some. And if you don't mind,
I've only got a couple of minutes, so.
Yeah,
I can answer one quick question now, and then I've got to go.
Okay, Sean, why don't I let you do the question then?
No, go right ahead if you want.
Okay. What I was thinking, and first of all, thanks for jumping in, and we will definitely have you on a subsequent webinar as well. I think that one quick question would be, what has been succeeding uniquely in your region? What have you seen that's been moving the needle?
Well, I mean, it's an oldie but a goodie for me, is that is crowdsourcing, where basically if you look at 99 Designs and Design Crowd, the top two design platforms, both Australian, freelancer.com, one of the top couple of work platforms, Australian-based, the third biggest crowdfunding platform in the world is Australian-based, Kaggle, the data science platform came out of Australia. I was always saying that that's what Australia should do, is, you know, use its expertise, talent, actually a lot of the expert platforms around Australia too. And so I love it, because my most recent book is on crowdsourcing. I believe in the power of crowds, and I love that Australia is positioned well now. And I'm not sure that I know quite why, but I've always had this theory that, you know, we understand we are very distant from the rest of the world. So we have to go to these ideas of, you know, platforms and connecting work and being able to run distributed projects. And Australia actually is one of Australia's massive strengths, is education and, you know, global education platforms and a variety of guises, but also in professional services delivery across Asia. And so these are all these expertise platforms, which is obviously very promising for, you know, Australia's positioning in a you know, connected talent economy.
I was just going to, and I'll let you go to whatever you need to get to if you can jump back on, great, Ross. But I do find the Australian experience similar to Canada, and I think other perhaps Nordic countries, maybe some in Asia as well. Small countries, based on not having the market size that they have and maybe having some type of cultural thing that embeds them in, they tend to be pretty good at supporting innovation, just because they have to be very choiceful. I look at Sweden and its leadership in gaming and certain elements of healthcare. And so it seems like Australia, your insight about crowdsourcing and just a whole bunch of companies that kind of surfaced probably a decade ago in Australia have really set the tone for Australia. I might throw it over to Andrew right now. You've just come back from Europe. Is there a European perspective?
I'll hop up now and I'll try to get back on the call a bit later.
Thank you, Ross.
Thanks, Ross.
Good luck. Good luck with everything.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about Europe, and then I'd like to go back because there's a question from the group. Thank you very much, by the way. This community today is full of good questions. There's one from an attendee that we'll throw back to Indra, which is I'll tee it up for you so that you can think about it, and I'll speak for a moment about my recent experiences, somewhat humbling actually, in Europe. So your question that you can think about is, do the noted limiting factors like the power differences also inhibit the adoption of innovative technologies? Or is it more applicable to, you know, sort of yourself or your own innovative solution development? So, you know, does it go as far as technology? So we'll get back to that in just a moment. And thanks for the question from the group. So I'll talk about something really interesting for people who are on some of the people that I work with. I have a kind of second life that's in Aalborg, Denmark, and I just recently came back from the Copenhagen FinTech Week. And it's a global group. I'm lucky to be on the global advisory board. And I gave a keynote on something that I thought was actually quite challenging, which was in fintech, you know, big tech and fintech, and how you should create, once again, as we said earlier, bedfellows. You know, are large companies to be trusted, or are they to be not trusted, as we said earlier? And the second part of that is, what would the Nordic region, and, you know, I think about the people that I met from Europe, from Singapore, certainly, people from Japan and people who were gathered there looking at the advantages of the Nordic region and what that would mean in terms of, being able to leverage that to the advantage of corporate growth. And one of the things that I found really interesting is that Silicon Valley, this bubble that we talked about, was not front and center in the conversation at all. I think that I have been drinking the Kool-Aid a bit too long. There was a lot of conversation about China, for sure, as Indra said, but the notion that all innovation would be coming from Silicon Valley, you know, which is a bubble view, was certainly not there. And I also think that what you were saying a second ago, Sean, was really evident, which is, for a region it's just as likely, and I'm very interested in what we'll talk about in terms of Colombia and Africa in the next one as well, you know, for a region to think about, as Indra said earlier, the and Ross just mentioned, you know, the relationship with government, regulatory environment, policy, politics. In Europe, it's really clear that those are all intertwined, and you can't have a region lead if there is an acknowledgement of the global regulatory environment, as well as the corporate leadership, as well as the youth and the technology and the talent. And it feels to me like that formula is very well understood in places that have not been necessarily the places where the population can be their whole market. So there has had to be much more knowledge about other regions as they pick their, as I said, bedfellows. So I think that, you know, in terms of the perspective I just had, there's always a question about Brexit. You know, there was always a panel about Brexit. There's always discussion about regulatory environments and the ability for corporations, you know, where should they locate? Where should headquarters be? Does it matter? And I think what Indra said earlier about, ultimately, it comes down to the brains, the brain power, the talent, the innovation, the ingenuity that you can bring to the equation. And if you can attract people like that through quality of life in Copenhagen, for instance, right? Quality of life in Amsterdam, quality of life in London, then you've got a leg up. And that was my takeaway from being there a couple of weeks ago.
Very good. And I know Andrea just teed you up with the question before she went into her European perspective. Indra, do you have a thought in terms of that power distance and adoption of emerging technologies in your part of the world?
Yeah, sure. I think it is more toward inhibiting the self-own innovative solution development rather than adoptions of innovative technology. Why? Because mostly in most companies, when it comes to innovations in terms of technology, the vendors actually do the convincing to the top management. So power distance doesn't actually relevant there. But the main concern or the main challenge in terms of power distance is not even, we haven't talked about creating innovations. Even when power distance is very high, then people don't question what their boss is saying or whatever happened within the company. And therefore, there are no rooms whatsoever for innovations to actually happen within the organization. So yeah, power distance is actually not just about it's inhibiting innovations in terms that, your boss actually does not agree with your idea. Even the environment doesn't allow for the idea to come in to actually emerge at all.
Yeah.
That's
it's interesting. I mean, there's probably degrees here, but I think myself and Andrew have committed ourselves to trying to figure that one out for global companies, because I think what's happening in Asia and what you've just said is happening inside big companies everywhere, and perhaps that's the page that we can take from startups, where power distance in startups pretty low, right? Like you probably have very consistent access to whoever the CEO is, and if he's a good one, he or she will probably listen to that feedback. So I think there's something to be said there from a company perspective. I'm going to take this one step down. I think, it's funny. We usually have five or six questions that we wrap up ahead of time and go, these would be great questions. And oftentimes in our webcast, we get to about three of them. So I may end up sending everyone that was a panelist today kind of a Q&A. So we'll have like a long form blog post that maybe gets at some of these things in greater detail. We might have covered this, but maybe like a real quickie for all of the three regions represented, you know, whether it's a customer tech or route to market, talent or economics, you know, what's the one defining thing that is driving innovation forward? We may have mentioned it already. I think from an Australian standpoint, we certainly heard some things that are holding them back. I've always viewed Australia as kind of like America light. And I say that with one of the most complimentary thoughts. They have a very rich entrepreneurial culture that you know, they're so far away from everybody that of course they have to be great salespeople and market themselves and export their ideas. So I think, you know, I'll speak to Australia in Ross's absence, that I think just having that chutzpah at a entrepreneurial, and I think some of that pervades into some of its corporate levels, is probably key. Maybe European perspective, Andrea.
Sure. I think in the conversation that I had with Lars in preparation for this as well, I think there are two things. One is that the core values, including things like an ethos around sustainability and quality of life and those types of values, as well as the trustworthiness, those cultural aspects, as well as the regulatory environment, and knowing that government wants to step in and have a point of view around how business should operate, I think is really front and center in Nordics. And I think that what's happening clearly, you know, Boris Johnson and Brexit and all of the things happening in the UK, there are lots of conversations around who's going to headquarter where and what's going to happen there. And that's so obvious, but I think that it will also have to do with which schools attract which talent, you know, and which people can get work papers to work in which place if UK is not in the EU anymore. And I think that's all going to really have a big effect on the millennial generation, where they, you know, where they have freedom to live.
And Indra, I know there's many different parts of Asia, so I'm almost like trying to glue this one thing together. But is there one defining thing that you go, wow, if Asia will rule the next, you know, decade, it's going to be because of this?
There are two things, actually. Number one is customer, obviously. In many Asian countries, the number of populations itself is actually the main drivers of innovation. You know, well, in Indonesia, we sometimes joke like this. You know, we are so lucky living in Indonesia. Why? Because we have all the problems in the world, right? sanitations, populations, traffic, and it's all kinds of problems we have in Indonesia. And why we are so lucky? Because we all know that problems gave birth to innovation, right? So there are plenty of rooms for us to innovate in Indonesia. And we have more than 250 million people in Indonesia. Only less than 20% access for banking. Internet penetration is still low. Lousy infrastructure, et cetera. So for some people, they see that as a problem. But for us innovators, we see that as opportunity, right? So this huge customer, this huge market, they are actually growing from mostly low end of customers. Now they are more middle class customers. So they have more money, they are more educated, they want something that is really helping them build their lifestyle. And what happened in many Asian countries, such as Indonesia, is this population, these customers, they don't often get great services or great products. You name it, in telecoms, in bankings, almost in any sectors of industry. So they got okay services, okay products. Now imagine if you can come up with just slightly higher value of service, or even you can wow them with your service or with your product, then they will switch easily.
Wow.
So this is a market that is not just huge, but prime for undertaking. So what we are actually worried in Indonesia is that, well, we hope Indonesians do the undertaking, not somebody else outside the country do the undertaking. But, you know, this is a free world. Everybody can get a piece of anything anywhere in the world. So yeah, number one is customers. We have Asian countries, not just Indonesia, has a huge population, untapped potential market. And secondly, we have all kinds of problems in Asia, and it's all waiting for somebody to actually solve the problem. And people just will, you know, with the right business model, people will happily be your customer.
So there's a
thing from nasty problems come great solutions, right?
There's a follow-up question from for Indra from Khairul Anwar, I think from Malaysia. Okay. And he's asking, I think it's a he, do you find customers willing to spend on innovation programs, which sometimes may be perceived as wasted effort? So what's the appetite for innovation among your corporate customers?
Well, most corporations or corporate leaders, they all talk about innovations. You know, they all speak about, you know, wanting to have innovation program within the company, but not all those companies actually have budget to do so. So they are trying to do it in-house within their own organizations, within their own leaders. But as we all know that, you know, you can't cut your own hair. You know, you have to, somebody has to come to you with a fresh perspective, neutral, not limited by the current perspectives of the company. So just to answer the question, I think more and more companies are actually willing to spend on innovations program. The question is how much, you know, how much would you spend on that innovation program? Some companies actually, those companies who are now currently working with us, they spend quite some to create an overhaul transformations of the company. So like 5,000 employees are getting not just trained, but coach. And we have like up to 100 different projects for innovation. So yeah, there are some companies that actually want to pay for that innovation program. But not all companies are like that. So some are actually rather picky in terms of choosing which program to use. So they don't want to spend too much money on that.
Great, thank you.
We're getting to the last few minutes of the conference or the webcast. I am going to zip through a couple of slides. I'll let you guys choose, but we cannot talk about these. And one of the polls that we've got in advance of this is it easier or tougher to do business in your region? Easier, same, tougher, don't know. Indra, a one sentence, is it easier than a decade ago, same or tougher? And then maybe just like a quick one sentence on why.
I would say easier. Can I say why?
Yeah, just quickly.
Okay, it's not about regulations. It's not about resources. It's about technology. So technology actually helps you to build business quickly, and you can just scale quickly as well. So easier.
Okay, Andrew, for Europe, what do you think?
I think tougher. I think tougher because of the politics.
Yeah. And then Australia, I'm going to go tougher as well. And part of it's the politics as well, being the country between China on the east side and US on the west side. They're probably the two biggest markets. And just how do you play one off on each other? Hopefully I haven't offended Australians. And maybe if we have poll results, I don't know if we've given sufficient time, Joanne, but if we can pop those up. And
oh.
It seemed like easier, although, not huge voting on that, but, you know, at least for the people that have chimed in, easier. Sure. All right. Top innovation barriers. I had four in terms of leading disrupted industries. Maybe choose one for your region. Which is the most exciting disrupted industry for your region? Andrew, you want to choose one for Europe?
I would say fintech.
Okay.
I think that for a lot of reasons, I like what Indra said. I'm going to use that now. The notion that all of these problems are really opportunities. And so I think that the fintech world is really disrupted. And that's also consistent with the research that has come out of the work that you've been doing, Sean, leading.
Wonderful. And Indra, for Asia writ large, what's the most interesting industry you'd be looking at?
I would say retail and commerce.
Yep. Massive markets, changing ways in how they right. buy stuff. And then we'll do one last one here. What's the top emerging technology for your region? Back to Andrea, when you think about Europe, what's the more interesting?
I actually think that although a lot of people doubt that blockchain is a big technology, you know, of course, AI, machine learning, you know, that's a given in that world. But I think that the really interesting applications of blockchain were incredibly impressive. With the work that I've been doing recently, including in places like wind and some, you know, pretty interesting places to apply blockchain.
And then Indra, for Asia, what's the most interesting technology?
I would say Internet of Things.
And is there a specific part of that that has got your fancy?
Well, because a lot of countries in Asia, they are the factory of the world, right? So IoT is definitely like one of the key elements to make sure that the quality efficiency is there.
Wonderful. And speaking for Australia, I know they have a number of different Internet of Things projects going on. What Australia has is a lot of space, and if things fall out of the ground or if there's a self-driving car that hits something, it's probably not going to be a person. So certainly a lot of different Internet of Things things going on for Australia. I'm going to zip through these. I'll probably send these out as questions to all of our panelists, so we'll have a nice blog post afterward. And our last question was going to be, which region will dominate the next decade of innovation-led growth? And we've got all six of our regions here. You can pick your own, Indra, or you can play another favorite here. Just quickly, before we hopefully we'll get the votes in. What do you think, Andrea? Who's going to win the next decade?
Is it Andrea or Indra?
I will take either. I knew that was going to be a problem this year.
Okay, I go first. Obviously, I would choose Asia, not because I'm from Asia, but a lot of experts say so. So I go with the experts.
Yeah. Well, a little bit of hometown rooting too, probably. Andra, let's phonetically pronounce that. Andrea, what do you think will be the biggest for the next decade?
Yeah, well, I've got to go with Asia, but you know what? The next webinar, the next webcast, I might go with Africa, but this time go with Asia for a lot of reasons, different reasons. Working right now in Japan, I think, is very different from working right now in China. That's my experience right now. And I think there's growth from both sources of pain in both regions.
Okay, a little bit of groupthink here too, because I will probably say Asia as well. So it's good testament, Indra, that two North Americans here are suggesting Asia is going to win the next decade. My dark horse though is Africa. I think back to legacy again. There's not that much legacy when it comes to corporate innovation, right? So they can create their own. I have a couple things before we open up to questions, we'll drop in the poll answers if people have answered shortly. Interesting. Africa and Asia were both kind of tied for the lead. So the experts know what the people know, right? Some housekeeping before we open up to questions. We do have three follow-up webinars. We are getting on a monthly cadence of doing these. We've got our August one on leading innovation. We've got a September one on the 52 business models of the future. We've ranked them, and so we're going to be showing our selections there. And then myself and Andrew, we're spending the next 3 or 4 days together writing not a book. And so we will be introducing the fruits of those efforts with special guests and panelists on October 22nd. So please sign up, the links are there. This could be what it looks like, maybe not, we'll see this week. And obviously for this webinar and the one that's about to happen in 2 hours, we host them all at futureproofingnext.com, Futureproofing Now, and we've posted our previous 4 episodes there already. And if you still want to take our global innovation study, we still have open links, so if you want to participate and get the free insights from the study, answer our battery of questions at those links there. And as well, finally, we've got a guild. We are producing a guild of 66 innovators around the world. If any of you that are listening to this, we would be so humbly glad to have you at least send us a message and say, hey, I might be interested in being part of what you're building. And there's a number of different things that we've got in the works. So we'll open it up to questions if there are any. I know we've asked some throughout.
There is a question. I'll start with one that says, and it's for Indra. Corporate innovation relationships with startups. What works in Indonesia? So we always talk about the ecosystem, and I call them bedfellows. And that there are large corporates, and I liked how you said legacy and emerging. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there's an importance to have everyone do their role well. So what is the dynamic of that? We call it an ecosystem, which is jargon, but you know, that's the way we describe it. What's the dynamic? You know, there's startups in Indonesia, larger companies, global partners. You know, are you looking at having, you know, basically how do the arrows point? You know, are you developing innovation and it's scaling elsewhere? Are you localizing corporate innovation from other places and regionalizing it? What's the dynamic there with the startups?
Well, startup ecosystem in Indonesia is not as well developed as in other countries. It is, in fact, actually far from Singapore, for example. So it's very in the baby step, in the baby phase. But the connections between big corporations and startups is actually already happening. There are some venture capitals or accelerators that actually help these big corporations to meet up with their startups and try to create projects or products, or even a new a venture together. So it's actually happening at the moment, and nothing is quite happened at a quite fast pace. So hopefully within the next few years, we'll be seeing more and more startups actually working together with the big corporations in order to get access to the resources, to the customers, so that their ideas, their innovations can scale up much faster. But again, I think it's too early to say that Indonesian startups is actually in a good position in terms of when we compare it to Singapore or even Thailand. So we have a lot of homework to do. Building that ecosystem and also the connections with the big corporation.
My hope is there is a development for next year where we can bring you back, Indra, as part of a Asian-specific innovation webcast where we actually tear through the four or five distinct different regions of Asia and have people chime in on a very, you know, country-specific basis as well. So,
sure.
Any other thoughts or questions? I don't have a line of sight to any questions that some.
I think there's one last one that we always like to end with, which is if you could let the world that's outside of your region understand something really impressive and exciting about what's going on in your region, what would you tell everyone who's in the community about, you know, the surprising thing that we might not realize is happening? I mean, not everybody knows that there are 260 million people. That's probably one thing. But what would a surprise be, or something really that gives you a sense of corporate optimism for growth?
You mean in Indonesia or in?
Yeah, in Indonesia, I think, because that's where you live and breathe pretty much every day, right?
Yeah. Oh, right. So as I mentioned earlier, that we have all the problems in the world. From the small problems to big problems. And we also have a bonus demography in Indonesia where young people are actually much more than the senior people. And these young people are actually well-educated. They study abroad, back home, and try to solve the country's problems. So what we are seeing in Indonesia in the next few years is actually, I believe, would be a massive innovation effort, and hopefully the government actually support that, because the current government is actually indicating that they actually really want to push innovation forward, supporting the startup ecosystem. So hopefully all those plans is actually put into implementation. And we are actually inviting companies or investors from outside Indonesia to actually look at what we have in Indonesia, not looking at just the how beautiful the countryside and everything, but look at the problems that we actually have and find a great business model, because maybe most people would not want to pay for it, for the solution. So, but with the right business model and the right solution for each problem, there are huge market in Indonesia. So at least that's what I'm seeing with my fellow startups. And we are so excited about trying to find the right problem to solve and then coming up with lots and lots of different solutions to experiment with.
Wonderful. Yep, I guess I'll mention from Australia's standpoint, because I think they're similar to Canada in some respects. We export ideas, right? We don't have the big markets that Asia or the US or even parts of Europe have. So we're hungrier. I think Australia has kind of an innovation mindset to its core. It's a question of just making sure, as Ross mentioned earlier, that their government and other functions, educational institutions, get behind it as well. Do you have a thought on, do you want to speak for Europe, Andrea?
No, let's see. I think that the surprising thing is that how optimistic people are despite despite Brexit. I think the same way as in North America, you know, there are lots of differences around whether we have the political agenda nailed down here in North America, or I won't even say North America, I'll just say the United States. So I would say for Europe, I think the surprising piece is the incredible energy, optimism, and sense of collaboration that I believe can be a huge benefit in this next set of corporate challenges. The ability to know how to pick those bedfellows and make trusting relationships, I think that optimism is palpable.
All right, we're coming up to the hour now, so I'm going to close this out, first of all, by thanking our panelist, Indra, for joining us. I know it's night there, but we very much appreciate it. We hope that our other two panelists are getting to wherever they need to get to.
We're losing you.
And a couple other things. So we've gone around the world, or at least half the world, in 60 minutes. In 2 hours' time, myself and Andrew are jumping on with another set of three guests, Eric, Brian, and Marcella. We'll be talking more North America, South America, and Africa. So if you are still around, join us for another hour and you'll get the full world. So,
And I'll be betting on Africa, by the way, in that webinar, just to be politically correct.
Playing favorites here, right? So thank you for everybody that's joined us today. Thank you for your questions and involvement. Thank you for our guests. And we look forward to seeing you very shortly in the future.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, Sean, for having me. Thank you.
Good to meet you, Indra. Yes. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.